okay?
Yeah.
Yay! Now, we're going to be learning a new song. I think that's next, yes. So we'll listen to it through once, and then we will sing it. Spirits and bodies allow. Join in singing, "Please Rise." Hymn number 1000, "Morning Has Come."
Unitarian Church of Alton. My name is Yomi. Welcome to this place. This is a home where no revealed truths are promoted and no scriptures or human beings accept it as infallible. This is a place that searches for truth, but we are believers. We believe in intellectual freedom. We believe in justice. We believe in compassion and concern for each other and the whole world. We believe in commitment to those ideals that make us caring and active in the struggles of human dignity. We are Unitarian Universalists. I offer my welcome to you, and in particular to those who are first-time visitors. We welcome you and especially encourage you to join us after worship for coffee and conversation. Information about the church is available from the new member desk during coffee hour and from any of the people here gathered. We welcome you to fill out one of the visitor's cards found in the back of your hymnal and to place it in the offering plate or to give it to the usher. We'll send you our church newsletter for the next 3 months to let you know about the programs and activities going on here at church. We are glad you are here and hope to see you again on future Sundays. We do have a children's religious education program going on today out in our yard. We are doing our annual maypole today. We also have a professionally staffed nursery for infants and young children. Adults are encouraged to attend the adult religious education programs each week at 11:50. We welcome everyone to this home of comfort, spirit, justice, and hope. Okay, our announcements today. We have quite a few. Okay, from Debbie Lavelle. We had the first Pride planning meeting yesterday. Pride is the last weekend of June. We will participate. Okay, with the other St. Louis UU congregations. A service will be held at First Church St. Louis, and we will march in the parade. We are looking forward to fun. Okay. We are looking also for a feature car like Linda's VZ's. Oh, Linda Van Zandt's convertible. There's a truck which we plan to have youth groups decorate. If you have any questions or comments, please let Debbie know. Thank you. Sorry. Mona Herbert is collecting shoes for Water Project until May 24th. Thank you for all contributions so far. If you notice in the Kate Worger room, there's a bunch of boxes. Okay, today at 11:50, there will also be an RE meeting downstairs in the youth room. All are welcome. Please join us to discuss next year's plans for religious education. And on May 17th, there will be the annual congregation meeting after the first service at 11:50 in the sanctuary. Please come.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. My name is Reverend Sunshine Jeremiah Wolf. I am the interim minister here at the First Unitarian Church of Alton. That means that I come to you pre-fired. I will be here until the end of the next church year. We did sign my new contract with the board, so excited about that and looking forward to spending another year with you as you search for your new minister. I have a few announcements. One, today during the 11:50 time, we will be having a continuing conversation about the sermon and about pastoral care at First Unitarian Church of Alton. If you want to learn more about pastoral care or what it looks like here in this congregation, I do encourage you to attend that program. Also, next week, May 10th, will be our annual flower communion, so please bring your most beautiful flowers from your yard. For those of you new to our community, flower communion is a long-time Unitarian practice that we continue, where you bring a flower, and when you leave, you take a flower that you did not bring. So it's a way of kind of sharing the abundance within our community. And I know the Florissant just had its flower festival, and I know there's lots of flowers and wonderful things out there. So please remember to bring them next week. We will have some extras in case folks forget. If you have a child who you would like to be dedicated in our congregation, please let me or Juliet know this week. We will be having on May 10th a child dedication ritual as well. We don't do baptism in our denomination, but we do believe in dedicating ourselves as a community to the support and raising of our children. And so this will be an opportunity for families and our community to commit ourselves to the children in our community. May 17th will be the annual meeting, and next week there will be some opportunities to learn more about some of the big decisions going on in that. There have been a lot of rumors, I know. Probably the biggest change is that with the budget, we will be eliminating the RE coordinator position. And so we'll need to look at what that looks like in the coming year. And actually, there have been a lot of creative and kind of innovative ideas coming up out of that. And so next year should be pretty exciting, both for our religious education program and for our worship service. It does not mean the end of the religious education program, and I think that's the most important thing I want to abate at this point, that we're talking about an elimination of the position, but not the program.
We are very committed to our children and youth. And lastly, as some of you saw on Facebook in an email this week, I kind of lost it a little bit. We have been having some concerns with our kitchen, and the final straw for me was a moment when one of our volunteers discovered mold in one of our water crafts. And I freaked out a little bit because there had been a report of a congregation that had a botulism epidemic and one of their members died in Ohio. I was like, okay, we can't have that here. And so I apologized because I was very forceful in my concern for our kitchen. It was a reactive place, and I'll talk about more in the sermon, but I did want to apologize for that for folks who were aware of it. And with that, that concludes this morning's announcements.
We begin our service this morning with a prelude. Today is a poem by Shel Silverstein, The Little Boy and the Old Man. Said the little boy, "Sometimes I drop my spoon." Said the little old man, "I do that too." The little boy whispered, "I wet my pants." "I do that too," laughed the little old man. Said the little boy, "I often cry." The little old man nodded, "So do I." "But worst of all," said the boy, "it seems grown-ups don't pay attention to me." And he felt the warmth of the wrinkled old hand. "I know what you mean," said the little old man. As Lane Simpson lights our chalice this morning, please join me in reciting these words. Love is the spirit of this church, and service its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. Please rise as your spirits and bodies allow, and join in singing hymn 1012, When I Am Frightened.
Thank you.
responsive reading is 658 in the back of the gray hymnal. To risk. To laugh is to risk appearing the fool.
To weep is to risk appearing sentimental.
To reach out for another is to risk exposing our true self.
To place our ideas, our dreams before the world crowd is to risk loss.
To love is to risk not being loved in return.
To hope is to risk despair.
To try is to risk failure.
To live is to risk dying.
So, as promised, this week we are going to try something different with our joys and sorrows. I know some of you are curious and excited, and many of you are sad and frustrated, and I hope that you will join me in this time of experimentation. I want to say a little bit about why we're doing this change. One is, everything that I do with you is to try and make you look as wonderful as possible to future ministers who might consider this location. I have yet to meet a colleague who is upset that I helped a congregation let go of joys and sorrows spoken from a microphone. There are a lot of reasons for that. One of the biggest ones is, speaking our joys and sorrows from the microphone tends to mean that we hear the joys and sorrows of our extroverts, of the people who are really comfortable speaking in front of a crowd. And for folks who maybe aren't willing to do that or more introverted, those kinds of things, it doesn't necessarily create that space for connection. And so one of the things I continually ask myself around joys and sorrows is, how do we have it be something that is meaningful for everybody? So for the next couple of months, we're going to use a sort of ritual that involves stones and water, and then an embracing meditation. And the embracing meditation we've done a few times, and that's where you speak the names or those that you wish to have considered in our thoughts and our meditations from your seats. The stones are kind of like lighting a candle, except that you can take as many stones as you want, one for each joy or sorrow or concern that you have going on, and then you let it rest in the water. And we let our stones gather, and then each month we ritually clean them, and we start anew. You will notice that as you enter into the sanctuary, there are bowls that have these stones. You don't need to have them now. We also have stones at the water, and that's what we'll use today. And so in a few minutes, I'm going to invite you to rise. And so that we have some organization, I'm going to invite you to come up this aisle, take your stones, meditate, place it in the bowl, and then exit down this aisle so we just don't end up with a padlock. Okay? That makes sense? Okay. So I've been holding on to two stones this morning. One has been for the kitchen and meditating on myself being responsive rather than reactive, and also hoping that we can come up with some resolution. And the other stone has been for some of the anxieties and fears I know this congregation has been holding on to with all of the change and everything. And so I want to let those go now by releasing them into the water. So as we sing, and I will lead the singing, it's not going to be on the wall, just follow me. I invite you to come forward as you are willing and able, and place a stone or two or five, as many as you need to, in the water to release those joys and those sorrows most close to your heart, a ritual of community.
Gathered here in the mystery of the hour,
thank you.
I invite you now into a time of prayer, meditation, or contemplation, as is your own personal practice. I invite you to be. Be here. Be here now. Be here now together. Be here now together as we breathe in and out. And in and out. Be here now together as we celebrate those joys and celebrations that live in our lives, of connection and laughter, of children and hope, of the power of change and possibility. In a week when the Crips and Bloods can say, we can get along, I know there is hope in the world. In a week when people go out and continually heal the earth with their hands and their hearts, I know there is hope for the world. May we to embrace all of those celebrations and gifts that life has to offer, the beautiful flowering plants and trees, even as they may make it hard for us to breathe. The beautiful river outside this amazing sanctuary and all of the amazing and wonderful people here gathered. And even as we lift up those celebrations and joys, we know that we are in a time of sorrow, of uncertainty, and of fear. In this week, when Baltimore explodes yet again due to the murder of another young black man. In a week when a young black woman was killed in Atlanta and another in Houston. As the list grows larger and larger, our hearts are heavy. And with communities feeling backed into a corner with no hope for change, finding a voice. May we find a way to move forward together, and may we hear the pain of those who are speaking out in the only way they know how. For those living with illness and loss, those who have lost loved ones, and those living with uncertainty and fear in their lives, may they find respite and rest and comfort. May they be with those fears, knowing they are a sign of what is true and what matters. We offer a blessing to those stones here in this bowl, given by the hands and the hearts and the thoughts of those in our community. May they be blessed in this day and in the days to come. And may we offer our blessings of celebration and or support to those named now. Freddie Gray. For all those named and unnamed, and those joys and sorrows lying in the silent sanctuary of our hearts, we offer our pleasant presence and our caring, and as always, our love. I invite you now into a time of silent meditation, prayer, or contemplation. Be here now together. Be here now. Be here. Be. This will be a moment. We will now sing Open Our Hearts. And we will sing it more times than you feel comfortable with. Just keep going with it.
Words of Paul Beadle. Once upon a time, most folks used to use the offering plate to fulfill their pledges of financial support. Nowadays, lots of folks click on their church websites or set up automatic transfers from their own banking accounts. Some still write a monthly check, paying their church bill along with all the others. But passing the offering plate was never just a practical exercise. It has always been a ritual. Even if your pledge is paid up, it is worthwhile for you to bring even just a dollar to drop into the plate as a ritual reminder of that form of love we call generosity. Let it be a reminder that after meeting our obligations to ourselves and our households and the communities to which we belong and are committed, we must still keep our capacity to give. The practice of giving until it is second nature and first response helps bring forth the realm of love. The offering will now be gratefully received, maybe joyfully given.
Please join me in our offertory blessing. To the work of the church, which is weaving a tapestry of love we call community. We dedicate ourselves, and these are offerings.
Our reading today is an excerpt from the invitation by Oriah Mountain Dreamer. It doesn't interest me what planets are squaring your moon. I want to know if you have touched the center of your own sorrow, if you have been opened by life's betrayals, or have become shriveled and closed from fear of further pain. I want to know if you can sit with pain, mine or your own, without moving to hide it or fade it or to fix it. I want to know if you can be with joy, mine or your own, if you can dance with wildness and let the ecstasy fill you to the tips of your fingers and toes without cautioning us to be careful, to be realistic, to remember the limitations of being human. I want to know if you can live with failure, yours and mine, and still stand on the edge of the lake and shout to the silver of the full moon, yes. Rises your body's willing. Oh, sorry, never mind.
I missed the word.
How many of you, when you fail at something, feel like going out and saying yes to the silver of the moon? Certainly not our first instinct, is it? And yet there are days. There are days after the 500th person has followed me around the store trying to figure out what my gender is, after my family has done yet another silly thing that just drives me bonkers, after my cat has puked on the rug again, after another black man has been killed and I feel compelled to be in the streets, after I learn that another person I care about has cancer. In those days, the last thing I want to do is shout at the moon. Then I remember, even with all of those millions of difficult things, there's a moon to shout at. There's hope out there. There's light and there's love. But when I'm in those difficult places, I don't necessarily want to shout at that moon. It takes a little while to get to the point where I feel that strength and want to say yes. I think of the things that occur in our community all the time. The person living with cancer who holds on to that 60% chance of making it, that number, as if somehow that makes the difference between being alive and not. That person with cancer whose family is so struck with the pain and fear of loss that they can't even talk to their loved one anymore. That person with cancer who's so afraid and so alone. I think of that woman who has miscarried for the fifth time, who mourns every single one of those children that she miscarried, and who keeps it to herself because she thinks that society doesn't want to hear about it, that somehow those children are not real in the eyes of some people, and that grief alone is alone hers to bear. I think of that person who needs a heart transplant but is afraid to accept the heart because for them, their spirit, their soul, is located in the heart. And what if they lose themselves if they get a new one? But feel foolish even thinking it and so afraid to tell their families.
I think of that 16-year-old child who has been raped by her father and doesn't know where to turn. Of that 50-year-old man who was raped by his father and didn't dare to speak it until now. I think of that 6'3" football player lying in a hospital bed after attempting suicide, whose only thought is anger at himself for failing to kill himself. Isolated and alone and absolutely sure there is nothing left to live for. These are all stories I have heard, and there are countless hundreds more where those come from. Some of them are stories from within this congregation, some from congregations I've served in the past, some from the hospital, all of them alive and possible at any given moment within any given community. In any given week here in this congregation, I receive 5 to 6 calls from members and friends of this congregation looking for care and support with something that they are dealing with. This week alone, I had 7 calls and visits. And those are just for the really urgent things. Then there are the daily living things. All of them require something that we in the ministry call pastoral care. And pastoral care is one simple thing. It is presence. But presence is not an easy thing. I sometimes have a hard time being present in the moment with myself, let alone with someone who is so hopeless, feeling so hopeless that they've given up on life entirely. It's hard to be present to that level of pain and loss. Pastoral care asks for that kind of presence. And pastoral care is not a quick fix. It's not a something you do. It is merely presence. It is, as Araya Mountain Dreamer says, being with someone's pain without trying to hide it or fade it or fix it. Now, how many of you, when you hear somebody's deepest pain, just want to sit with that pain for a period of days? Right? I see no hands up. It's not something we volunteer for. And yet, it is exactly what is needed when we provide deep care and concern for those who are suffering. Because the truth is, there's no way out but through. It's presence without an agenda or an expectation. And it's a presence that is responsive, not reactive. Now, how many of you, when you heard some of these stories that I mentioned, felt something within you? You had an emotional response to it. We're talking about some really deep and heavy stuff, so that's expected and understandable. Part of pastoral presence means being present to someone and letting your emotions be yours and not giving it to someone else. And that is really the hardest part. It is deeply difficult to listen to someone's pain, particularly if it's a pain you yourself have experienced. And yet that's what we're called to. Brené Brown does a lot of work on shame research, and one of the things that she points out is that for someone to feel real support in a place of shame where they don't, you know, want to share something that they've done because it means they're a bad person, what they need is someone else who understands that shame experience. She talks a lot about motherhood and being a mother and feeling this great shame that she didn't get the cookies done for the bake sale and that she was absolutely sure she had failed as a mother for not getting those cookies baked. And when she didn't get them to the meeting, and of course one of the mothers complained and said, well, you didn't do your job again, it affirmed every bit of shame she ever had. And she had to call one of her friends that she knew got it and say, you know, I'm feeling terrible about this. And she goes, Yeah, we forgot to take the kids to karate yesterday. You know, it happens, you know. I get how difficult and how much that says about you. And that was what she needed. Somebody who met her where her experience was affirming and not saying, oh, you shouldn't feel that way, it was just cookies. Which didn't meet her where she was emotionally. Does that make sense? So being pastoral, being somebody who's in caring relationship, is about being responsive to where a person is without trying to move them to somewhere else. In ministry, ministers are required, well, at least some denominations, Unitarian Universalists are certainly among them, are required to get training as chaplains. And that means serving in a hospital and with a very specific kind of curriculum and program that's offered in any hospital. So you go to one hospital, they're getting the same training as, you know, a hospital in another state. And it involves 300 hours of meeting with patients and 100 hours of what they call didactic time. And that time is spent talking about what was going on for you. So if I meet with a patient who's suicidal, the time in our group meetings were about what was going on for you when you were meeting with that person who was suicidal. Now for me personally, I was remembering my friend Kevin who committed suicide when I was in high school. For another person, it was their own experience of feeling suicidal themselves. Each of us has our own different relationship with us, with it. And some people, they're like, oh, suicidal people, I have no problem working with them. And other people are like, oh, I can't do it. It burns me out. It's too emotional for me. And part of that practice is knowing when I'm the person to respond and when I'm not. That's sometimes hard to see. And so one of the things to hold to your heart in all of this work of being pastorally present to someone is to know thyself. Now, in the original phrasing in the Greek, know thyself was about knowing yourself outside of society, kind of removing yourself away from it for a moment. So it requires a form of practice that is intentionally self-reflective, that is essentially a spiritual practice of meditation, of contemplation that is separate and apart from. In other words, that when you know yourself, you are more able to respond to the world around you. This week, I had a prime opportunity to practice this when I was informed that there was mold discovered in one of our kitchen's servers, and I posted on Facebook a somewhat ultimatum of this is what's going to happen. And that was from a reactive place. That was me responding in fear. And I was not being responsive to the congregation. I certainly did not follow any proper protocol. I was in no good place. I was all about the fear. It just was no presence at all. And so it took a couple of days. And what's interesting is even as I was kind of responding to the comments on Facebook and all that, I knew that this was not the way to handle it. And I couldn't stop myself. Any of you ever been in that road? Like, I know this isn't the road to travel, but I'm knee deep in it. It was because it touched an emotional place in me. And when you're emotional, you are anything but rational. And the truth is that we are the same way with our family and with our friends. That if somebody else's pain is triggering us, is revving that stuff up, we may not be the kind of person we want to be with the people we love the most because we got all that stuff churned up in us. And if we live with it and sit with it, I sat with my anger and I sat with my fear for a couple of days. I called my mentor like I'm supposed to. I did my meditation time and calmed myself down and figured out what my triggers were. And today I was able to apologize, and I will continue to apologize, I'm sure, and to recognize this is what the trigger was. And what's important about that is the next time this happens, because it's a church and there will be another kitchen with mold in it, I won't respond that way. I won't react that way. I'll be more responsive to it. And part of the practice in pastoral care is knowing when you're triggered and being with it and using it as a learning tool for the future, as a way to kind of be and practice. We're going to hopefully approve a covenant in a couple of weeks that it talks about acceptance and respect and engagement, but we know in the creation of that covenant, we will break it. I broke that covenant this week, right? It's not even voted on and I already broke it. But it's because that's the standard we want to hold ourselves to, not because we're going to live up to it always, but because we're always working towards it. Does that make sense? So when we're thinking about a pastoral response to people, we're talking about being aware of our own crap, so to speak, so that we can be more loving with the people around us, and most truthfully, loving to ourselves. Because the truth is, we cannot be compassionate towards another person if we don't hold that compassion towards ourselves. And for some of us, that's the hardest thing in the world. There are a few ways to practically do this, and I really think that if we become more pastoral in our responses in our worlds, we can influence that in our society as well. You know, and I can't imagine what would happen if we taught our police to, yes, be protective, but be pastoral. To really think about and be in the shoes of the people that they serve. What would be different? What would be different if a police officer could say, yeah, in that heat of the moment, I made a mistake, and not have the fear of being fired or sent to prison, and yet have the power of making amends? There are a few things we need to do first, though. One of the things to know is that when we're in those reactive places, our limbic brain, our lizard brain, is totally in control. I don't know about you, but my lizard brain's like, I'm out of here. I'm done. I like to leave. I don't know if you're a fight person or a flight person. I tend to be a flight person. And it stays in that emotional place. And one of the first ways that we move it out of that deeply emotional, reactive place is through storytelling. Because in the storytelling, we engage our frontal lobe. And it puts those emotional emotions into our rational center. And we're able to make sense of it. And when we can make sense of it, we become less reactive. It is just a biological reality. And also, we make narratives of our lives. We make stories of our lives. And it puts our experiences in the context of something we've actually been living in. So some of my folks are like, well, how can you do pastoral care with atheists? And I'm like, you know, they're people too, just because they don't believe in God, right? They have narratives too. Atheists, humanists, Christians, we all have narratives we work within. And we all have experiences when the narrative doesn't work for us anymore. And that's where pastoral care comes to all people. It's when our narratives don't always meet the truth of our lives. So a mother who probably believed most of her life that a child who was lost to a miscarriage wasn't a big deal and then has a miscarriage herself finds a dissonance between what she has always known to be true and her own experience of that truth. So there has to be a reframe, and how do we make sense of and bring this into our own lives? So having a narrative and understanding and listening to people's stories, just listening to people tell their stories, goes a long way to helping people heal those deep, powerful pains in their lives. And the other thing to remember is it's contextual, that it lives within the truths of our world. So for example, Brené Brown, and you know, I didn't get the cookies baked, so I'm a bad person, is part of a larger narrative that mothers hold themselves to in our society about being Susie Homebaker, who gets everything done and works a full-time job and doesn't sweat. Right? There's kind of this elusive image of what motherhood's supposed to be. And when we don't fit what it's supposed to be, we get out of relationship with ourselves and the world. And that is a part of it, is looking at the context. It's not just that individual person. It's what is society telling them is true. One of the big ones I know about is making people feel bad about being overweight, which then, of course, invites them to feel like they want to do something about it, right? Just want to eat more, right, you know, right? You know, that we have this narrative that somehow if you are of a certain size, then it says something about you as a person. And what does that narrative do when people are feeling in a despairing place, right? It creates a disconnect. So how do we make sense of the stories within which we live? The other most important thing for the person providing care is to be self-reflective, to be aware of one's own experience, to be continually critiquing how one is in relationship with the people around them. Because the truth is, you can't control other people, you can only control yourself. I know some of you, that is a hard, hard lesson to learn. You really wish you could just make people do it the way you want it done. You know who you are. And the world doesn't work that way, right? You know, it has to start with our own reflection, our own awareness, and when we do that, we're more able to be present to the people around us. I want to share one quote about this. When caregivers relate the care seeker's story to the meta-narratives of the culture, the overarching stories, the meta-narratives are a culture's underlying values and myths. For example, the myth of scientific progress, that modern Western culture is progressing in a direction in which scientific knowledge will accumulate until the problems that cause suffering are solved. We've heard that one, right? Anybody believe that one? Some of us? Yeah. This belief in scientific progress may provide hope when care seekers focus on physical aspects of suffering and wish for medication to dull the pain or halt the spread of cancer. But science often can't provide remedies for spiritual and emotional pain. Soldiers wounded in battle may receive the best available medical attention in the aftermath of combat and still carry deep psychic wounds. Another meta-narrative in the United States is the belief in the power of the individual to conquer all odds and rise to success, the self-made person often portrayed in the media. The role of these meta-narratives are like a belief in science and individual success in shaping people's worldviews, their beliefs. And their construction of knowledge is highlighted when caregivers use a contextual approach. In other words, when we attend to those overarching beliefs, we're able to see more deeply how that influences our sense of self, of worth, of our own personal values, and the ways those may or may not serve us as we're facing our own trials and struggles. Pastoral care in a congregation is not an easy thing to do, which is why ministers are often overly trained in it, and why they are often the ones responsible for it in congregations that have ministers. And yet, a minister alone cannot complete these things. Cannot do it because, really honestly, there's not enough hours in the day. I love you all, but I'm not giving you every single hour of my life. I gotta sleep now and then. And I love pastoral care. It is one of my favorite things in ministry. So if you're like, oh, I don't wanna bother Sunshine with it, please bother me. I actually like being present to people in this way. It took a lot of practice. Lots of practice. But it's one of my favorite things. And for some of you, it may be one of the things that you love to do too. Now, this congregation has had a pastoral care program in various forms and renditions, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. We definitely have great pastoral service. That's when you provide rides and food. In fact, I loved it when Jim Moore said, okay, you can stop bringing me food now. That was a great moment this past week, you know. And, you know, people say, okay, that's enough of the service. Like, we do very well at that. But the pastoral presence is something that every congregation struggles with. And the people who need that pastoral presence most are in three categories. Those in emergent crisis, which are the ones that the minister really responds to. People who are dying, or someone who's just died, someone's getting married. Okay, so it could also be positive things, it's not all bad stuff. Somebody who's been just diagnosed with an illness is facing some major loss in their lives. The second kind is somebody who's living with chronic illness. That could be mental health, that could be addiction, that could be IBS or COPD or any of the kind of long-term illnesses. And then the third one, and the one that most frequently gets lost, are folks who are homebound. They're just not physically able to come to church anymore. And we tend to lose contact with them for a couple of reasons. One, they often feel shamed that they can't come to church, because when they used to be able to come to church, they volunteered constantly. And now they don't have that to give. And oftentimes, they are on less income, so they can't pledge as much. And so oftentimes, we end up with folks who it's not that they don't come to church because they don't want to, but because they feel embarrassed or ashamed about their participation. And so in that group of folks, we want to make sure that we have someone who's keeping them in the loop, maybe agreeing to sit down and talk to them about the most recent sermon on a monthly basis, sending a care card, those kinds of things. And the same thing is true with people living with chronic illness, just checking in once in a while, seeing how things are going. just listening and being present. And really, that's all we're talking about, is listening and being present. And so when we think about what we want in this congregation in a way to respond to the pastoral care needs of this community, we want to think about, what is our ministry of presence? Who should be providing that presence? How do we make sure that it's provided and that people know how to take advantage of it? And how are we continually providing opportunities to educate and train and help people respond to their own reactivity so that they can be more present in their pastoral ways? It is one of the most important aspects of congregational life. And in the Unitarian Universalist denomination, it is one of the most varied in terms of people's expectations. How many of you are raised in a Catholic church? How many of you consider going to your priest for any of those kinds of pastoral concerns? Not a one of you. And that's pretty normal in the Catholic church. How many of you are raised in like a Baptist or Pentecostal tradition? Okay. And how many of you automatically think you should go to the minister if you have needs and cares for in that tradition? No? Okay. That's unusual. It's pretty common that folks that come out of the Baptist tradition automatically just show up and talk to the minister and ask for help and, you know, get support. And so all that to say, we have differing experiences of it. And ministers don't always know how to respond. Do you want help or do you not? And we will do what you tell us to. But just know, if we're not always calling when you think we should, or maybe we're calling you too much, it's probably because it's a little wishy-washy as to where and how we're supposed to be with our communities. And that's the same with everybody seated here. We want to be with each other, but it does require our communication. At the end of the day, it means risking presence. It means saying yes to the silver moon, even if it's that silver moon is a little scary. Even if all those things are a struggle. Know that we are enough to hold it. Know that we are enough as we are. And that whatever experiences you may be holding in your life, whatever struggles you may be facing, you are not alone. May it be so. I invite you to rise as your spirits allow, bodies and spirits allow, and join in singing hymn number 100, I've Got Peace Like a River. How many folks know this hymn?
Thank you.
invite you to turn across the chandelier towards your own neighbors. Actually, because of the way this is working, I invite you to look across the aisle instead, because I don't know what happened. Meet up with a lone ranger over here. It's all good. This is our sacred community. When you are feeling the fear of the night, the despair and uncertainty of loneliness, know that we are here for you. These smiling faces, look at these people around you, say yes, yes. Say yes to the silver spoon, to the light of the wonder in the eyes around you. Say yes.
Yes.
Say yes.
Yes.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Yes.
Yes, may it be so. May we be together in this day and in the days to come. Blessed be and
yes.
Yes. Our service.